From WYPR in Baltimore, this is Midday. I'm Aaron Hinkin, in for Tom Hall. If you're old enough to remember this summer 50 years ago, there's probably a day that's etched in your memory, a day when you looked at a black and white TV set and saw Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. After the crew of the Apollo 11 made history on July 20th, 1969, more American teams followed. And then, 3 years later, just as suddenly as the momentum had built, it stalled out. We haven't set foot on the moon since. But it looks like it won't be long now until we make a return. In the hour ahead, we're going to look at our human ventures to the moon and beyond. That's coming up on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon. Welcome to Midday from WYPR in Baltimore. I'm Aaron Hinkin, in for Tom Hall. I'm going to start us off this hour with a quote. This is from a Russian rocket scientist. His name is Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. He said, "The Earth is the cradle of the mind, but one can't stay in the cradle forever." What do you think? What do you think of that idea? Do we human beings belong out there in space? Are we destined to expand our presence out there in the universe? Or is this whole idea, the idea of space travel, just a distraction from more pressing problems right here on Earth? That quote, by the way, "The Earth is the cradle of the mind, but one can't stay in the cradle forever," that's more than 100 years old. And as of this month, it's been 50 years now since we human beings managed to set foot on the moon. If you're old enough to have watched it happen on a black and white TV set, you'll remember it sounded like this.
30 seconds. Forward. Contact right. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
We're breathing again. Thanks a lot. From 1969 to 1972, NASA landed 6 human missions on the moon, and then, just as fast as things had gotten started, they stopped. We haven't been back there since. But it looks like that's about to change, and it might not be NASA that gets us back there first this time. Later this hour, we're going to look at who's likely to get us there again and beyond when we talk with Christian Davenport. He is the author of a 2018 book titled The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. And I want to welcome you to join the conversation this hour as well. You can talk with us on the air at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email. We're at midday@wypr.org. Or you can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. First up, I am happy to welcome to the program Oliver Morton. He is senior editor at The Economist and author of The Moon, A History for the Future. Mr. Morton joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. And Mr. Morton, welcome to Midday.
Thanks very much for having me, Aaron.
And I should say, I learned that quote from that Russian rocket scientist reading your book, along with a whole lot else, and I'm really pleased to have you on the program today. I want to start with a photograph that you call the most important picture of the 20th century. It's called Earthrise. Let me ask you to tell the story of this photo. What do we see in this picture? When and where was it taken? And just what kind of an impact did it have on our collective psychology back here on Earth?
Well, this is a picture, a very famous picture, which I imagine everyone, almost everyone, can picture in their mind's eye. Apollo 8, which is the first American mission to take humans to the moon. The first 3 orbits of the moon, the guys are looking down at the moon. And then on the 4th orbit, the spacecraft's orientation has changed. And so they're looking at the edge of the moon. And suddenly they see the Earth come up over the edge. And they're struck by its beauty. And they scramble for the cameras. And they get the cameras. And they get this extraordinary image of the Earth rising above the edge of the moon. Now, when they first bring this back, obviously they can't transmit it. The radio's nothing like that good. So, no, this is on film, and it's treated like a holy relic when it comes back and when it's processed. And then it's sent out, and it's sent out with the moon as basically a wall on the right-hand side of the picture, and the Earth hanging off to one side in space. And that's kind of like two planets in space. But by the time people start publishing it in magazines, on magazine covers, or on the front page of the New York Times, it's twisted around so the Earth is rising above the moon. And you cannot help but make the contrast between the very featureless, kind of melted-looking, empty, grey, browny blurriness of the moon, the jet blackness of space, and this extraordinary little jewel hanging in the sky, flecked with little curves of white and dark blue and the ochre of deserts. There's a little bit of green in there. And you suddenly, and the world realized that the world was kind of special. And although the Apollo missions do an awful lot of terrific stuff, and obviously there's something quite extraordinary about Apollo 11, which we're celebrating this month, it's that insight of the otherness of the universe being very alien and hard, and the Earth being quite strange and changing and lovely. I think that's, you know, an extraordinary legacy for the space, for that first act in the space age to have.
Mr. Morton, you write in your book that that what we see when we look at the moon is a reflection of ourselves, of our, you say, of our preoccupations and theories, our dreams and fears. Talk about what you mean by that. Take us back maybe to the very earthly geopolitics that got us focused on a moon landing in the first place.
Well, at one point, it was actually true that many people did think that the moon was a reflection of the Earth, that it was a great mirror in the sky. But if you look at the moon in the first times when it's becoming absolutely clear that it's possible that people might go there. So Tsiolkovsky, who you quoted earlier on, he first realizes that liquid-fueled rockets might be able to do this, might be able to go to the moon. And at the end of the Second World War, we actually see that the world has liquid-fueled rockets. It has the V-2 rocket, which was built with slave labor by Nazis to attack Belgium and England with. And people who worked on the V-2 and actual V-2s get taken to the Soviet Union and to America, and it becomes clear that yes, this technology can get into space and maybe it can go to the moon. And the immediate thing that people imagine is that the moon is some sort of like strategic high ground in the new Cold War, which is clearly about to begin between Russia and America. And this idea that the moon is strategic high ground carries on for some time. And then the moon becomes, in Apollo, just a measure of, President Kennedy chooses it as a measure of America's best efforts, of its best ability to coordinate both its huge economic potential, its national will, and its technological gifts, its gift for technological innovation, into just the goal that America needs. And there's nothing really that special about the moon. It's just the goal that at that time resonates. And so people look to the moon for the sort of thing that they want to see there. And I think that will continue to be the case.
This blew me away when I read this, but I guess in 1967, Apollo was taking 4% of our government spending budget. Is that correct?
Yep. I mean, your government spent a lot less back then, but yes, I mean, it's a massive, massive undertaking. And the thing that's really extraordinary about it is how very, very pyramidal it is. So the base of the pyramid is something like 400, a workforce of something along the lines of 400,000. It's amazing when talking about the moon how often I actually find people in the audience that say, oh yeah, my dad or my granddad worked on that, or oh, my aunt did something. And, you know, but that pyramid with this huge base of American working power narrows and narrows and narrows until at the top there's just this tiny little conical thing with three people in it. And so it's similar in scope, in logistical scope, to something like D-Day, except it doesn't move an army across an ocean. It moves just three people way out into the sky and brings them back. It's unlike any other human endeavor in the breadth of its base and the tiny little amount of payload.
You talk about the political will at the time to do this, the fire, so to speak, that was lit under our sort of collective technological minds to make it happen. We intended to do this fast and to do this first. And ironically, I learned reading your book, one of the side effects of our sprint to get to the moon kind of left us without a long-term plan or an infrastructure to get back there again anytime soon thereafter. Let me ask you to talk about the psychological repercussions of that back here on Earth, the orphans of Apollo, as you call this generation of young people in the late 1960s who saw this happen and then saw it end and ended up inspired but like ultimately disappointed by our space program.
Yeah, I think it's a very, I mean, I think I'm in my early 50s. I don't remember the first moon landing. I remember one of them, and I've never been able to quite work out which one it is. I should go back and look at family records of when I was staying with my Uncle Martin. Anyway, that's not what he wanted to know. I feel this sense that something else was going to happen. And I think no one thought, I think, at the time of the moon, people in the know knew that Apollo wasn't a going to go on endlessly. They knew that by the time Apollo 11 had landed, the last Apollo missions had pretty much been cancelled. They knew that all the Saturn V rockets that were going to be built had been built. But everyone thought that surely something was going to happen other than just coming back. And there was some of your listeners may remember, there was a small American space station, Skylab. And the idea was that the space shuttle would get up and running before Skylab fell down out of the sky, and then the space station would lift Skylab to a high orbit, and then they would be built out, and there'd start being a space-based economy in the 1980s. And you know, none of that happens, and the space shuttle doesn't become a truck that goes up to space every week as it's advertised to. It becomes a very specialist, very extraordinary piece of engineering, and obviously one that had a troubled and, in some way, and you know, to a real extent, tragic history in the losses of two crews. And we kept on, humans kept on exploring the solar system, but they just didn't do it in person. And I don't think anyone really expected in 1972 that no one was going to go back to the moon for 50 years. And I think a lot of people genuinely were disappointed about it. And one of the reasons you see what you see today and what Christian's going to talk to you about later is that some of those people are now billionaires who think that they're pretty good at making rockets. And in the case of Elon Musk, have demonstrated that they're very good at making rockets. And so they feel that the universe or the world or someone in their parents' generation broke a promise to them, and they're going to make that good themselves.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos, I think, was 5 years old when he saw the moon landing. And that that's sort of the beginning of his story, a sort of story that's persisted, as we're going to hear later this hour, up to the present day with the Blue Origin, his space company. Let's get back to this idea of using the moon and our study of space in general as a way of better appreciating our own planet and like our place in the larger cosmic picture. You talk about looking out as a way of looking back at our own origins. Let me ask you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, one of the fascinating things about the moon, as I mentioned, is that it doesn't change. The last time the moon looked any physically different to the way it will look if you look up at it tonight, there were dinosaurs on the Earth, and it didn't look very different back then. And one of the great things about that is that little bits of the Earth, when the Earth is hit by asteroids and comets, such as the one that got rid of the dinosaurs or administered the coup de grace to the dinosaurs, little bits of the Earth get thrown out into space, and some of those little bits of Earth land on the moon. And the further back you go in history, the less and less of the Earth there is still on the Earth, because the Earth's surface changes all the time. You know, the continents bang together and mash each other up. And there are really very few rocks on the Earth that are more than a billion years old, and very, very, very few that are more than 3 billion years old. And so when you get right back to the time when life was first evolving on the Earth, sometime around 4 billion years ago, we might guess, there's more rock from that period from the Earth on the moon than there is available to us on the Earth. So the moon, there's a lovely phrase that some scientists came up with, that the moon is like the Earth's attic. There's a lot of junk there from a long time ago that no one really remembers having put there, but it's still there, and it still might tell you something about great-grandma, or in this case, great-great-great-great-great-grand cell somewhere.
Right.
And so, you know, the Earth and the moon, they're neighbours, and they're kind of siblings, and they have stuff to say to each other. But the other great thing is, of course, the contrast, that the moon is just so unlike the Earth and just makes you so aware of how the ability of stuff to move around on the Earth, to flow in winds and in ocean currents and in avalanches and in strange undersea currents, turbidity currents, all these things matter massively to the fact that the Earth contains and supports and encourages life. The moon really makes you feel the absence of that, and a long-term presence on the moon would give you this extraordinary experience of trying to recreate that from scratch, and an experience that we've had in designing submarines, for example. Rebuilding what it is that life requires to stay alive in a place that really does not want any life at all.
And doesn't change either. I mean, that footprint, that famous footprint that we've seen the photo of, is probably just there as it was the day it was made. We're going to get ready to head to a break here, Mr. Morton. I want to let listeners know we're talking with Oliver Morton from the studios of the BBC in London. Mr. Morton is a senior editor at The Economist and the author of several books. His new book is called The Moon, A History for the Future. We're back after the break with Mr. Morton, and I want to invite you to join the conversation as well. What do you think? Do we belong back in space? And if so, what do you think we should be doing up there? Give us a call, the number 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email, the address midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet. We are @MiddayWYPR. We're going to go out of this segment with a revised version of David Bowie's Space Oddity, this one recorded by Commander Chris Hadfield on board the International Space Station. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. Quick look ahead here. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks and guest host Rob Sivak. They're going to be discussing the immigration crisis on the southern border and exploring in a larger sense the meaning of courage in this time of deep political divisions. That's tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us here today, we are talking about space travel. A little bit later in the program, Christian Davenport is going to join us. He covers the space industry for the Washington Post. Right now, we are lucky to have on the line from the BBC studios in London, Oliver Morton. His new book is called The Moon, A History for the Future. And listeners, I want to welcome you to join the conversation as well. I'd love to hear what's on your mind on this topic. Give us a call. The number 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet. We are @MiddayWYPR. Mr. Morton, it seems like you really can't properly talk about space travel in real life without also talking about our fascination with science fiction books and movies. Let me give you a chance to talk about the impact of sci-fi on the real-life space program, past and present.
The thing about science fiction, I think people forget that until the early 20th century, the notion of the future, the late 19th century, the notion of the future was a very undefined one. Science fiction in the 19th century almost always takes place in the present. Frankenstein is in the present. The moon missions in Jules Verne are in the present. The War of the Worlds is in the present. But around the turn of the century, people start thinking that because science is involved with progress, there must be some sort of like scientific way of talking about what progress will bring in the future. And we develop this sort of like identikit view of the future that becomes the background for all sorts of thoughts about what's going to happen. And one of those, one of the components of this, what I suppose what you could call one of the tropes of this, is space travel. Because the things that people decide they're interested in, and this is partly due to a number of factors, including the fact that this is a literature that's very much targeted at adolescent boys, the idea is about personal power, about victory, about some sort of like transcendent ability, possibly linked to being clever and brainy, but not all that physically strong. And one of the things that comes up here is rocket ships. And rocket ships really do inspire people, the idea of the rocket ships. Almost all the people working on rockets between the First and Second World War are inspired to some extent by fiction. Robert Goddard, the great American rocket pioneer, very, very inspired both by H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds and by an unauthorized knockoff sequel called Edison Conquers Mars that came out a year later. And people like Hermann Oberth in Germany, very influenced by Jules Verne, also influenced by Tsiolkovsky. The people who make the V2 during the Second World War, the people who design the V2, not the poor unfortunates who make it, are the same people who talk to the great film director Fritz Lang about his film about going to the moon, Frau im Mond, and they talk about building rockets as part of the promotion of the film. So this whole idea that if there's any technology that's really fundamental to science fiction, it's the rocket and the super weapon, because that's the other great power fantasy of science fiction. And after the Second World War, you are in a world that has both rockets and super weapons. And so science fiction becomes, for a moment, very much this idea, a more widespread thing. You start seeing it in the Saturday Evening Post. You start seeing it in Collier's. It bursts out of the pulp magazines, and it's actually how people are talking. People are talking about weather control and vast computers that can understand everything. And good Lord, there may even be 10 of them in the future. And so, you know, science fiction for that time, and it's very noticeable. So, like, for that time, sort of like 40s, 50s, and 60s, becomes a very clear way of imagining a not necessarily bad future. And then later on, things we develop a much more problematic, perhaps more realistic sense of the relationship between humans, technology, and the future in a more pessimistic mode in the 1970s and then on. But there is this time when people really do sort of like open Reader's Digest and see pictures of colonies on Mars and think, that's fantastic, but maybe that's also true.
You mentioned the movie director Fritz Lang. This blew me away when I read in your book the reason why they count down backwards from 10 is because they decided to do that in the Fritz Lang movie, and NASA just thought that was cool. Is that right?
Well, the Germans who worked with Fritz Lang thought it was cool, and so the German rocketry program used that as its way of marking things. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. Because it has to do with the fact that film changes the way humans see time, and so it can move forward or backwards. And Lang just realizes that 10, 9, 8, 7, that's an amazing piece of tension. And so, yeah, it's purely dramatic tension, but we now think that it's the way to... It's very hard to imagine rockets without countdowns.
Let's talk about the human forces that are currently luring us back to the moon and beyond. There's obviously pure science. There's the fundamental thrill of exploration. And then you've got money, right? People are looking towards space to make a profit. They're thinking of space as a place to mine resources and maybe create factories. Talk about the dollar signs that people are seeing, how realistic those dollar signs are, and then maybe a little bit about what the repercussions are for, like, a commercially zoned moon, for example.
Yeah, I think that at the moment, people are making a good bit of money out of space because a lot of communications traffic goes through space, and increasingly there's a market for images of the Earth taken from space in various different wavelengths, and there's obviously a large market for satellite position data, which you get from GPS satellites. So that's all focused, you know, from space looking down. It's all from near space. I mean, it's all from an awful lot nearer than the moon. Now, there's an argument that you want to go further out into space to actually build things. And that's something that, for instance, Jeff Bezos believes very strongly. And he takes that belief from a physics professor from Princeton in the 1970s called Gerard O'Neill, who talked about building huge factories out of space and huge cities to house the workers who would work in the factories. And eventually the idea was that all heavy industry, including the power industry, would all be out in space, and that things would then just be exported down from space to the Earth, which would become greener and more pleasant. And you'd beam down energy, and you'd send down all sorts of wonderful things that can only be made in zero gravity. And there are some things we know of already that can be made certainly a lot more easily in zero gravity. There's some kinds of optical fiber, which it's plausible to imagine being made in space and shipped to the Earth. But for really large-scale stuff, no one's, as far as I can see, really defined a market that it's clear that you can make a lot of money from. So take the moon. It's got some metals on it, and it's probably got some concentrations of metals that haven't yet been seen, but whether they're metals that it's worth going to the moon to get in that quantity is a very open question. There's a substance called helium-3 that's mixed up in a very low concentration in the moon dust that makes... that some people think would make a great fuel for fusion reactors, but we don't have any fusion reactors.
Right, there's a small problem there. Yeah,
exactly. And if we did, there are other fuels you could use in fusion reactors. And so like the people talk about three generations of fusion fuels, and helium-3 is only the second. And so if you can get to the first, you can probably get to the third, and maybe you can skip the second. The interesting thing that's new is that the moon does seem to have resources which not necessarily worth shipping to Earth and or to orbit around the Earth, but might make a difference for someone who wanted to actually live on the moon, which is there appears to be water ice and some other what people call volatiles, things like ammonia and methane and carbon monoxide, quite possibly frozen into eternally dark craters at the poles of the moon. And that might not be a resource worth exploiting financially, but it might make building a moon base a great deal easier.
And then, of course, there's the immediate cash cow, which appears to be space tourism. I'm going to save that conversation for our next guest this hour. This is a real deal that's got lots of money behind it, and we'll hear about that in our next segment.
Very good for orbit. The moon is the only place beyond Earth orbit. I mean, going to Mars to leave... Mr. Musk talks about colonizing Mars, and I'll leave that for Christian, but it's not a place to go on holiday unless you want to spend 3 months going on your holiday and then 3 months coming back. Whereas the moon, you can imagine people going to the moon for the holiday of a lifetime, and you can imagine rich people paying a great deal to do that. And we spoke earlier about the sight of the Earth above the moon. I can imagine some places on the moon where you would have a big glass window and something a bit like an infinity pool, and you would look out at the flat plane of the moon from your craggy mountainside and see the Earth above it. And I think that, people who have a spare $5 million, and there are people who have spare $5 million, might think that was a way to spend it.
We're going to talk more about that idea in the next segment of our program. Right now, though, I do want to say thank you, Oliver Morton. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. Oliver Morton is senior editor at The Economist and author of the new book, The Moon, A History for the Future. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great talking to you, Aaron.
Midday continues after a short break when Christian Davenport joins us. He's the author of the book, The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. But before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2019, 165 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. 10 homicide victims who died the week before last have now been identified. They are Antonio Jackson Jr., age 33, Harold Amos, age 45, Robert Davis, age 43, Jordan Taylor, age 26, Antoine Webster, age 32. Raymond Johnson, age 44. Sheridan McElwee, age 47. Joshua Norman, age 24. Darren Benjamin, age 36. And Devon Dorsey, age 21. And this past week, 8 other people lost their lives to violence in the city. So far, 4 of them have been identified. They are Tisa Blout, age 20, Wayne Johnson, age 23, Kenyon Condry, age 20, and Yasmin Wilson. She was 20 years old. It's midday. I'm Aaron Henkin. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we are talking this hour about space exploration and a possible return of space travelers to the moon and beyond. This month, we mark the 50th anniversary of the first time humans walked on the moon. That was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on July 20th, 1969. Also worth remembering that the last time humans walked on the moon was only 3 years later. NASA does have plans to get humans back to the lunar surface, but they might get beat. They might get beat to it by private companies. Is that a good thing, you think, or a problem? What do you think about the idea that corporations should spearhead space travel? Or should that be better left to NASA and other governmental space agencies? Should space exploration continue to be primarily for scientific research, or is commerce an equally valid goal? Who should profit from space travel? You are welcome to join the conversation this hour. We'd love to hear from you at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. Christian Davenport joins me now. He covers the defense and space industries for The Washington Post, and he is the author of the book, The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. And he's on the line from The Washington Post newsroom. Mr. Davenport, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
You compare Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos to the story of the tortoise and the hare, Elon Musk being the go-for-broke sort of sprinter, and Jeff Bezos being the pace-yourself-for-the-long-game kind of a guy. And as aspiring rocketeers, their goals overlap to a degree. They also differ in important ways. Let's sort of take these characters one at a time. Let's zoom in first, if you would, on Elon Musk. Let me ask you to give listeners a sense of how he's built his fortune and what has compelled him to pour so much of it into space travel and his company, SpaceX.
Sure. So as you mentioned, Elon Musk is the founder of SpaceX, based out in California. It was created in 2002, and at the millennium, the turn of the millennium, Elon Musk had made some money on some of his other ventures, including PayPal, and was thinking about what he wanted to do next. And space exploration was always of a great interest to him, like energy conservation, and thinking that it, you know, could ultimately help humanity. So he went on NASA's website to look at what NASA's plans were at the time in getting to Mars, which he thought was the next logical destination. In the earlier half hour with Oliver, you had talked about the Apollo program and the moon landing, which we're celebrating this month. But, you know, Elon has always been thinking about Mars, because Mars is, a very distant neighbor. It's our closest planet that has characteristics that are somewhat and similar to Earth, and he has envisioned Mars becoming this sort of backup to the Earth in case anything happened to the Earth, as he says, an eventual extinction event. If an asteroid or something would hit the Earth and humanity would go the way of the dinosaurs, that we should have a backup, much in the way you would have a backup on your hard drive in case your computer crashed. But what he found when he went on NASA's website in the late 90s, early 2000s, was that NASA didn't really have a viable plan to get to Mars. And, you know, he thought that space was just too difficult, that the barrier to entry was too hard, and wanted to sort of, you know, in typical sort of Silicon Valley ethos, wanted to disrupt the space industry by building cheaper rockets and making it more affordable and more accessible so that, you know, these grand visions of getting to Mars, you know, could be possible. But, you know, let's just take a minute and pause. And I think Oliver alluded to this, that, you know, Mars is not a very pleasant place to be, no matter, you know, despite what you may see in popular culture in some movies. It takes months to get there. You know, it's a very remote. It can be very, very cold. There's a lot of radiation. It's just not a very pleasant place to go. But that's his idea, is that ultimately, if you can, you know, build a spacecraft that are more affordable, you can get there and begin to make it more habitable of a place. And, you know, I should mention, too, there are a lot of areas where Elon and Jeff Bezos have similarities, and that is, despite their personalities and sort of the cultural differences at their companies, ultimately what they want to do is lower the cost to spaceflight. I mean, they, you know, grew up, you had mentioned the term orphans of Apollo, feeling that humanity by now should have stretched out further into the solar system, and that, you know, we haven't. And today NASA does not have the ability to fly astronauts anywhere, and has not had that ability for 8 years since the space shuttle was retired. Instead, we pay Russia to fly our astronauts to the International Space Station. And, you know, look, that's 250 miles up. The moon is 250,000 miles away. So there's been sort of, I think, limits to the ambitions, and both of them want to, you know, build on that and go further.
Similar goals, different personalities, certainly different styles. I wonder if you might just, on the flip side, rewind and tell us the story of Jeff Bezos. He's amassed an incredible fortune, obviously, with the success of Amazon. He basically can, like, single-handedly compete with the budget of NASA. Tell us about his space company, Blue Origin, sort of how it came to be, and just sort of what kind of a style of enterprise that is.
Yeah, so, I mean, to understand Jeff Bezos, I think you have to see him not just as the founder and CEO of Amazon, but also you have to see him through the lens of space. I mean, that is one of his real passions, and it's been his passion since he was a little kid. I think you'd mentioned earlier he was 5 years old when he watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon, and he's talked about what a profound effect that had on him. And he was with Neil Stephenson, the science fiction author, and they were seeing Rocket Boys, based on Homer Hickam's book, and you know, I think in 1999 or 98 thereabouts. And afterwards, they were having coffee, and Jeff said to Neil Stephenson, "You know, this is ultimately what I'd like to do, is to create a space company." And Neil urged him to do that. And at that point, you know, he had been you know, building his fortune with Amazon, and now, you know, he says that Blue Origin is doing, you know, is doing the most important work, you know, that he could do. He's pledged to invest about $1 billion a year into it, but he's taken a very slow, under the radar, almost secretive approach. I mean, today I don't think a lot of people even realize that Jeff Bezos has a space company, and not only does he have a space company, Blue Origin is actually 2 years older than SpaceX, which gets a lot more media attention. Jeff founded Blue Origin in 2000, again, with this goal to ultimately lower the cost of access to space. And, you know, he said that when he founded Amazon, you know, that infrastructure was there for the Internet. So any entrepreneur, you know, Mark Zuckerberg could found Facebook, you know, in his dorm room. And anybody, you know, you could be in your garage and start an Internet company. But you can't do that in space because it's just too difficult. You know, with Amazon, there were the cable lines were there for the Internet. The Postal Service could deliver the books, a credit card, so he could take people's payments. So he could build Amazon on top of all of that infrastructure. But that infrastructure today does not exist in space. And so what he wants to do is help build the infrastructure, the sort of, you know, railroad. It's not a perfect metaphor, but to build, you know, the infrastructure so that he can make space more accessible, and then you can build platforms on top of that and ultimately help humanity not just go to the surface of Mars, which is what, you know, Elon Musk and SpaceX's plan is, but what Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin want to do is just to have humanity spread out into space. Earlier, I think Oliver was talking about Gerard O'Neill, the author of the book The High Frontier, and the whole point of that vision isn't that you go to any particular planet, but you spread out into the solar system by manufacturing in space and building massive, massive habitats. Now, again, this sort of blends into, you know, a bit of a science fiction fantasy, and you know, if this could ever come true, I think we're talking hundreds of years or generations into the future. But you know, in the near term, what Jeff wants to do and what Elon wants to do is just make space more affordable and more accessible.
Yeah, I think you're talking about this idea of people who have the ability to look into the deep future, you know, to see that long, long, long horizon. And the people who, you know, there are people who think these endeavors are absurd, and there are people who obviously devote great, great fortunes to them. We're talking with Christian Davenport. He's the author of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos, the Space Barons. Christian, we're going to go to the phones here. I have a call here from Mike in Pikesville. Mike, you are on the air with Christian Davenport.
I am. Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Just had a quick comment. I was a high school debate coach about 8 years ago, and this came up. And one of the more compelling arguments that my boys presented in that debate was questions about property rights for, you know, space and property in space and trading lines. You know, maybe it doesn't matter so much what the U.S. Decides as well as private or public funding of those projects, but other countries as well. You know, who gets to stake the flag and who gets to take those eventual property rights out there? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Mike. Mike in Pikesville there. Christian talking about international treaties, ownership of planetary bodies. Where does that stand? This is a new industry.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's a great question, Mike. So, yeah, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty says that, you know, there's no country can lay claim to a celestial body. But in 2015... Congress passed a law that said that U.S. companies, were they to go to a celestial body, whether it's the moon or an asteroid, and they mine for resources, that they would be entitled to those resources, the company would. Now, that hasn't been tested, and we don't know, you know, what sort of challenges could emerge from that in any sort of, you know, international court or tribunal. But, you know, that's something that the United States Congress has passed, and it you know, really leads to some interesting questions about what the future is, because now you've got the Trump administration, as you noted earlier, trying to get back to the moon within 5 years, and where they want to go is the south pole of the moon, where there's near continuous sunlight, which could be used for solar energy, but there's also ice and water at the poles of the moon, and that is important because it's not just significant for sustaining life as water and oxygen, but also the components of water, hydrogen, oxygen, could be used also for rocket fuel. And that's significant because then you could go deeper into the solar system and not have to bring your fuel with you. But, you know, I think there is a concern in the Trump administration looking around, particularly what China's doing, and wondering who's going to get there first and, you know, lay claim to this, you know, very important piece of lunar real estate.
It's interesting to think about this idea that, you know, wherever you go, you take yourself with you. I mean, we head into space, we bring our own human baggage with us, for better or worse. I mean, a moon, for example, born of antagonism is going to be a moon of antagonism. It really makes you think carefully about, you know, how and why you're going to these places. And I know that you're, you know, these so-called space barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and others have gotten together to really hash through this idea. They call it the Personal Spaceflight Federation. I wonder if you might talk about sort of their conversations amongst themselves as organizations about why they're doing this, about the prospect of death as part of this enterprise. I mean, talk about that, about how they're sort of taking those ideas into their own hands.
Yeah, well, so there are two things there. I mean, what you see emerging is, you know, a nascent industry. I mean, there's always been, you know, NASA's always relied on, you know, big government contractors to get to the moon. I mean, Apollo, Grumman was obviously a big one. And you know, today, Lockheed Martin, Boeing are still very big players in the space industry. But there's, you know, sort of more of a commercial, smaller startup, entrepreneurial industry that's bubbling up and trying to break into the market that really, you know, I think is represented by SpaceX and trying again to bring down the costs and to innovate and to move faster and not just to, you know, go at the pace of a big sort of aging government bureaucracy, but to move faster. And, you know, one of the things they're looking at, and you had mentioned this earlier, is space tourism. And this gets, you know, it gets risky anytime you're putting people on a rocket. You know, we should note that not only does NASA not have the ability to fly humans, but, you know, Blue Origin hasn't done it. SpaceX hasn't flown a person, and Virgin Galactic has done it now just twice, flying to the edge of space and back. That's Richard Branson's outfit. But I think space tourism gets overlooked. I mean, we talk about the moon, we talk about Mars. But this notion that a paying customer could go up to the edge of space, you know, and sort of what Alan Shepard did during the Mercury program on his 15-minute flight, where he doesn't go into orbit. It's a suborbital mission where it goes up, scratches the edge of space at about 100 kilometers or so, and comes back down. And you have that view of the Earth, and you see the thin line of the atmosphere and land masses without borders and the darkness of space. That could really be you know, a significant effect. I mean, astronauts talk about it all the time. They talk about the overview effect of seeing the Earth from a distance and gaining this real perspective and appreciation from whence they came. And you know, I think you talked about some of that with Oliver earlier on the show. But that also carries risks. And how do you regulate that? What happens when or if one of these companies has a rocket blow up and they're killing not, you know, NASA astronauts or test pilots, but, you know, just members of the public who had signed up for this. And I think they would argue that, you know, this should be regulated like bungee jumping or skydiving, where, you know, it's a dangerous endeavor, but you've signed up to do it and you think it's worth the risk. And so you're having that sort of, you know, really interesting conversation play out. And people think that this is, you know, years in the future, but Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin have talked about flying people as soon as this year. And as I said earlier, in fact, on two test flights, Virgin's already done it.
Christian Davenport covers the space industry for The Washington Post. He's the author of the book, The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. It has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much, Mr. Davenport.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks also this hour to The Diz for providing lunch today for our staff. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks and guest host Rob Sivak. They'll discuss immigration crisis on the southern border and explore the meaning of courage in this time of deep political divisions. That's tomorrow on Midday. That's it for us today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up right after the NPR News at the top of the hour. I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.